Welcome to the Sleaze Cast with Doc Sleaze.
Well, hello, and welcome to Sleaze Towers, where the Sleaze staff Christmas party is, as you can probably hear, in full swing. Oh, yeah. So far, so good. I mean, no unpleasant incidents like in previous years. Hey, wait, what's going on? Yeah, get down! No, off of there! Get down! Get down off of there! Now, thank you. Jesus Christ. Little Miss Strange, our sometime gossip columnist, climbing the Christmas tree again, decided it needed some kind of ornament on top and she was going to bloody be it. I mean, Jesus Christ, that's a couple of drinks and she's anyone's. I mean, at least it's not as bad as a couple of years ago, when she got so drunk on the eggnog that she climbed on the roof here and started throwing her shoes at passing carol singers. I mean, what mystified me was that she threw five shoes, and the last time I looked, she's only got two bloody feet. But, there you go. I mean, and then there was that other time when there was the snow on the ground, that time she punched out those two snowmen, because she didn't like the way they looked at her. I mean, I tell you, the woman's a trial. Oh, God. But getting back to the point here, as I say, you know, pop open a can, because I'm certainly going to do now, and, come and join me here for the Sleazecast Christmas special. You know, season of goodwill and all that. I mean, what's it all about? What? Hang on. Sorry about this. I'm just going to have to go a minute. Hang on. Carol singers, you know, always the worst bloody moment the buggers come round. Right, now, where were we? Why, Christmas, the season of goodwill. I mean, Christmas these days often gets some bad press, you know, because of the sort of shysters and con artists who latch on to this time of year, you know, to try and make some money, exploit people's goodwill, basically. I mean, for one thing, you get a lot of loan sharks at the time of year, don't you? Go around the council estates loaning money at extortionate rates to people who otherwise couldn't afford to buy any decent Christmas presents or whatever for the kids, you know, absolute scumbags. But there you go. And the other year was that business, you know, Lapland, wasn't it? Or, you know, Crapland, as it was called around here, you know, that that seasonally themed sort of park, you know, down the New Forest way, where the two guys running ended up being prosecuted, but they had to be released on a technicality, now I notice. You know, but basically people were sort of promised, you know, this sort of Lapland in the New Forest, where they expected snow-coloured vistas and reindeer and Santa's elves and all this, and in fact what they got was a muddy field and a sort of like a horse with fake antlers tied on its head, you know, that sort of thing, and a few not even proper dwarves, just sort of, you know, slightly short people, you know, dressed in green tights running around, you know. Yeah, in fact, some elves got beaten up, you know, Santa, you know, took a kicking, that sort of thing. But, you know, I mean, it's quite reprehensible, that sort of thing. Yeah, not that we do. I mean, we did have a little bit of trouble here because, you know, I did think, you know, in the season of goodwill, I did have Santa's seasonal shed out in the garden. I mean, you know, charged a quid a time for people coming in and see basic Santa's shed. You know, I mean, okay, I know it was my shed with a bit of tinsel on it and a few lights. You know, but some people were a little bit disappointed. There were some harsh words exchanged, some threats made. You know, I mean, I think that's completely out of order. You know, I mean, what were they expecting? I mean, you know, there were the three wise shovels in there. I mean, you know, there were three hoes. Ho, ho, ho. They get it. You do better, it's Christmas, for God's sake. You know, I'm not sure what they were really expecting in there. You know, there was the... sort of the tableau, you know, the baby Jesus bag of fertilizer sitting in a plant pot, and the virgin olive oil was on hand and all that. You know, I just don't know what they expected, really, for a quid in a shed. But so we had to stop doing that. You know, the council didn't like it, you know, but the council are notorious killjoys at Christmas.
you know, I mean, last year, the trouble I had over the Christmas decorations out of outside, I mean, you know, apparently someone complained about my tableau I had mounted out in the front garden, depicting the nativity scene using blow-up sex dolls. I mean, I really don't know what the problem was, but, you know, some people apparently objected, you know, to the Virgin Mary being portrayed by Sexy Sadie and 36 double Ds. You know, I was big, come on, I thought they'd be okay because I didn't have them fully inflated. So, you know, I was trying there to be restrained, but they didn't like that. That and, you know, and those lights are set up spelling out Merry Fuckmas, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, but they are just kill choice, you know. So this year it's all been lower key, apart from Santa Seasonal Shadow Course. You know, that's really been the centrepiece of my celebration so far. But as I say, cease and desist notice from the council, so there you go. What does one expect? But in a way, all these things like crap land and all that, in a way, are quite apt at this time of year, because in a way, they really symbolise what Christmas often has become. You know, I mean, you have all this expectation built up that's going to be great and wonderful, and expecting all these great presents and whatever. And in the end, when you unwrap your presents, they're in lovely paper and everything. And in actual fact, you know, you've got this expectation of something fantastic, and what you actually get is a Cliff Richard CD and a pair of socks, you know. So, yeah, I think things like the Lapland business were actually, you know, quite accurate reflections of what passes for seasonal spirit these days. Of course, one of those other great Yuletide traditions is that of the seasonal ghost story. So, if you'd like to come here and gather round this blazing log fire, I'll tell you a tale of a seasonal supernatural tale, entitled Room 69. Like all good Christmas ghost stories, this one starts on Christmas Eve with a stranded traveller, that traveller being me. It's a few years ago now, and I found myself stranded one Christmas Eve thanks to the heavy snow causing chaos and disruption to the transport system in this country. I found myself stranded in one of those motorway hotels, you know, the sort that Lenny Henry advertises on the telly. And, you know, the sort of place, you know, where basically failed comics go to commit suicide. And, each room has a complimentary dead hooker in it. But, you know, it doesn't matter how or why I was travelling this particular Christmas Eve. I found myself stranded there, and of course with lots of other people. I mean, there were no rooms available. So the hotel staff very kindly made us all as comfortable as possible out in the lobby. You know, people were sleeping on sofas and things. And, yeah, they brought extra heaters in, and, you know, sort of serving us with coffee and hot food. And, but yeah, I find those sofas and things not very comfortable to sleep on. And it's still a bit drafty despite their best attempts to heat the place up. And I found myself in conversation with a fellow stranded traveller. And he told me, I thought incredibly, that actually he always stayed in the lobbies of these hotels. You know, he never booked a room at them if he could help it, ever since an unfortunate incident some years before. And this is really the tale he told me during that cold Christmas Eve night. Whilst waiting for snow ploughs to unblock the motorway, he told me that some years before, one winter, he found himself booked into a fellow travelling salesman, because that's what he did. They found themselves booked in to a hotel, a hotel very similar to the one whose lobby we were in. Somewhere in the Midlands, off of the M6. And they were booked there whilst they worked the area, you know, made sort of sales visits and things to various potential customers there in that area. They're based at the hotel. Anyway, he found himself booked into room 68. Now, it went well, and the first night he went back there, and he's finally had a few drinks in the bar with his his travelling companion, then he retired to his room, room 68. And he drifted off to sleep, as you do. And so with a start, he was woken in the early hours of the morning by the sounds of screaming, apparently from the next room. It was a terrible, anguished scream, the sound of whipping. You know, as if someone was in absolute agony, being tortured in there. And also suddenly, as he leapt up from bed, he noticed something odd. The far wall of his room appeared to have moved close to the bed. The room seemed physically smaller. Anyway, obviously alarmed by this, he got out of bed and went next door, and basically went into the corridor and walked down, obviously, to the door of the next room, room 69, where he could hear these sounds coming. He could see a light, a little light under the door, and he could see movement, and then this sound went on, and he banged on the door. You know, obviously wanted to find what was going on, and shouted, you know, but, you know, what's going on in there, everything. And at that point, the sounds abruptly stopped, and the light from under the door vanished. He stood there for a while, but nothing happened. He thought of going to the lobby and sort of speaking to the night porter about it, but then thought, oh, to hell with it. And he went back to bed, went to sleep. Next morning he got up, and obviously he mentioned these events to the clerk at the desk. To his amazement, the clerk at the desk told him, there is no room 69 in this hotel. You know, you must have imagined it all. It must have been, you know, you sure you hadn't drunk too much, whatever. This is some kind of alcohol-induced hallucination. Well, obviously, my friend who's telling this story was very surprised to hear this. And of course, he went back and checked. And he counted off the room numbers, you know. On one side of him was 67. He was in room 68. And the next room was room 70. Said no room 69. And also he noticed that he recalled that he thought his room had looked smaller the night before, but now it appeared to be in daylight the size it had been when he booked in. So he thought, okay, maybe it was all a bad dream, you know. And so he went off to work that day and you know, did his sales pitches and everything, came back again, same thing, you know, had a few drinks in the bar with his friend, retired to bed. Just he's drifting off to, it's all nice and quiet, he just drifts off to sleep, and it starts again. It's horrible, agonized screaming from next door, and again it occurs to the room looks distinctly smaller. There's no doubt about it. Again he goes out into the corridor, hammers on the door. There is room 69 again. You think, oh, this is ridiculous, you know. I mean, maybe they're playing some kind of prank here or something. You know, what's going on? I mean, so he hammered on the door again. Again, the light underneath went out. The sound stopped. This time he decided he went down the lobby and got the night porter. He obviously thought he was mad or whatever. He gets back there. No room 69. The door's vanished. Goes into his room. Back to the same size as it was before. He tries to check with the occupant of room 70, where they heard him, but room 70 is empty. No, it was vacant, no one's staying there. So again, he thinks, okay, maybe it was a bad dream or something. You know, maybe I imagined it all. But there's still a part of him thinks this really happened. So on the third and last night that he and his fellow travelling salesman were staying there, he persuaded, after a few drinks in the bar, his companion to join him in room 68 and basically to see what happened. And they sat there, and of course nothing happens, and he thinks, begin to think, okay, maybe it was, he was feeling a bit embarrassed, you know, having dragged this guy and got him to give up his own room, you know, and come and sort of sit on the armchair in this room waiting for something to happen that is never going to happen. And just as they're both sort of beginning to fall asleep, when it starts again, sounds of whipping and caning and whatever. Someone's putting a severe beating in the next room. They're crying out in agony. And again, and his friend agrees, the room looks smaller. So they both go into the corridor. And his friend, there again, finds confronted by the door to room, the mysterious room 69. This time his friend hammers on the door. And this time, the door flies open. And they find themselves confronted by those terrifying sight. There, standing in the doorway, is what appears to be like a kind of undead dominatrix, some spectral leather clad black fishnet type wearing high heels on whip wielding dominatrix basically. Her eyes though are deep sunken, her skin is pallid and drawn over a bone. She looks gaunt and horrible and evil. She looks like she's being summoned from the depths of hell. Beyond her, in the room behind her, they can see spread eagle on the bed, his wrists and his ankles tied to the bedpost. Some poor unfortunate naked man who's basically got his penis and scrotum tied up basically in what looks like an agonizing way, whilst another hellish looking dominatrix whips them with a miniature cat o' nine tails. He's clearly had hot wax poured all over them. He's got clamps on his nipples. His body shows all the signs of having beaten, whipped and caned. They can see these implements in there of sexual torture. And most incredibly, the guy appears to have like 70s style hair and sideburns. Well, the whole decor of the room appears to be throwback to the 1970s. Anyway, whilst they stand there looking at this scene with incredulity, this dominatrix lashes out with a whip, catches my companion's friend around the legs with it, and drags him into the room, screaming. A chap telling me the story, he grabs onto his friend's hand and tries to stop him being dragged into the room. And he tries, and his friend is clearly terrified he's being dragged in there. And this woman, then the other woman comes and joins the first dominatrix and grabs the guy's ankles, and they're pulling him into the room, and the guy's, he's got, my friend is hanging on to one of his hands, trying to pull him out. He's got another hand, the guy's got another hand on the door frame, trying to stop him being pulled in. But they're too much for him. He can't keep his grip. And finally, he's pulled into the room, and the door slams in the face of the storyteller. He can hear his friend now screaming in agony himself in there. Obviously terrified. My companion in the lobby runs off to find the night porter and get the police alerted. And obviously there's a huge furore. The night porter and several other member staff come rushing back to the corridor with him, and of course the door to room 69 has vanished. Obviously they think, you know, he's a complete nutcase, this guy. But, you know, they found they check the other guy's room, the other travelling salesman's room. No sign of him. All his belongings are still there. But there's no sign of him. His car's still in the car park. What's become of him? Well, obviously, the chap telling me this story, there's suspicions. Obviously, once the police arrive, that perhaps he's done him. The guy's a nutcase. So he ends up being sedated and carted off to the local hospital. Meanwhile, a search of the hotel finally reveals, in room 70, the naked, bound and gagged body of the other travelling salesman, a look of terror on his face, with a huge dildo rammed down his throat, a butt plug up his anus, evidence of having been tortured with hot wax and given a severe beating. There he is, dead on the floor, obviously, of room 70, supposedly empty room. Of course, my friend telling me the story. He was suspected of having done the deed, but no evidence we brought against him, and eventually he was, no charges were brought, and eventually he was released from the hospital. And after some months, went back to his job, tried to put it all out of his mind, and the murder was put down, the death of his confederate put down as being unsolved, and it was left at that. Except eventually, some years later, he decided to revisit the scene of these strange events. So he went back to where the hotel had been and found it had been demolished in the meantime, and there was a whole new building project going on there. So he went to a local village and the local pub, and got talking to the barman there, who told him an extraordinary tale of how back in the 1970s there had indeed been a room 69 in that very hotel when it was first built. However, it was found eventually there were a series of disappearances of travelling salesmen also in the area, were connected to the hotel. It transpired that a pair of murderous prostitutes, dominatrixes, were using room 69. Basically, they were luring travelling salesmen there with promises. It was like three in a bed romps and amazing sexual experiences. And they were actually murdering them after torturing them and stealing their valuables before disposing of the bodies. No one knew where. I mean, eventually, I mean, the cars of these travelling salesmen were usually found abandoned several miles away. I mean, their belongings, apart from their valuables, were still in their rooms. Eventually, of course, the police investigated it, and the finger of suspicion was pointed at these two prostitutes, and eventually they themselves died in a fireball after a chase with the police. The police chased them down the motorway, and as they were in a car they'd stolen from one of their victims, and they crashed into a motorway bridge. Both are horribly burned to death. The hotel management, obviously not wanting any bad publicity, or to minimise the bad publicity, decided to eliminate any trace of room 69. So the room vanished, and the space that had been room 69 was divided between room 68 and room 70. Anyway, however, you know, another person at the bar sort of laughed after hearing the story and said, it's just an urban myth. You know, none of this actually ever happened, you know. Urban myth. However, later on that day, my friend on his way out, he went back to the building site where which had once been occupied by the hotel. And while he's there looking at it, one of the builders told him an interesting story. Told him of how when they pulled the hotel down and they were sort of digging up the foundations, they're the foundations of rooms 68 and 70. They found, buried underneath the floor, human remains. Yes, the remains of bones, apparently of several bodies, dating back, they thought, to the 1970s. They looked like they'd been beaten badly, tortured even. Of course, the police had investigated, but it was all put down to unsolved murders and whatever. No connection was made with the two prostitutes in the story of Room 69. Obviously, nobody wanted the bad publicity. The police just wanted the case closed. So there you are. And as my friend in the lobby told me, that was why he would never ever book into a room in one of those hotels again. So there you are, the cautionary tale of Room 69. So just remember, when you book into one of those hotels, there are worse things you might encounter there than Lenny Henry. Of course, nowadays here in the the Western world, Christmas is seen primarily as a Christian celebration, religious festival. I mean, you know, clues there in the title, isn't it? Christmas, Christ Mass, celebrating the birth of Christ. But of course, we all know really the actual timing of it is a hijacking by Christians of ancient pagan festivals, you know, celebrating the midwinter and the fact we're turning the corner now, where the days are now beginning to get long, you know, summer's coming back, you know, I mean, and a lot of these pagan traditions still persist. I mean, I myself the other day on the Lord's Day, we was down at Stonehenge, you know, sacrificing a virgin to ensure the return of summer again, you know, as we do every year. It's all quite harmless, really. But oh, for God, not again. Sorry, so I'm going to have to go and deal with this again. Sorry, anyway, my apologies.
Yeah, look, I told you once before, not next time. Fuck off, right? Fuck off.
You know, some people just don't get the bloody message, do they? Bloody carol singers again. You know, Jesus Christ. Sorry, where were we before we interrupted? Yeah, paganism, pagan origins of Christmas. Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes, of course, you know, the Christians don't like to be reminded of this. And you get these Christian fundamentalists as well, don't you? Who sort of, you know, go crazy and try and expunge all the pagan elements from Christmas now. I mean, I was reading only the other day about this group down in the West Country, apparently down in Plymouth, some department store Santa Claus found himself facing a lynch mob of crazed Christian fundamentalists. You know, poor bugger, they came and sort of forced their way into his grotto. Was he's got little kids there giving him presents, all this. They go in there, trash the place. They pulled Rudolph the reindeer when he tried to intervene. He got it in the groin with a cattle electric cattle prod. You know, I mean, apparently doctors said he'd be lucky if he ever gets a normal erection ever again in his life, the poor bugger. I mean, as for poor Santa, they chased him all through the bloody store. Apparently they cornered him out in the street, you know, and stripped him of his costume and his beard. They set fire to his beard ceremonially and nailed his costume, his red suit, to the door of a nearby church in some sort of Christian parody of, you know, like they used to sort of do. They used to skin Danes in the old days, you know, and put their skins on their skins to sort of doors of churches is a sort of warning to other Danes, don't come here because we're well-armed Christian Saxons, and you know, this is what's going to happen. This apparently is a warning to all other Santas down in Plymouth way, you know, stay away from Plymouth or this is the result. You know, and there was another incident, you know, down the road in Exeter, where one Santa very nearly was hanged from a lamppost. You know, he's out in the street ringing his bell, all this, giving it all that. This mob of loonies, all with prominent crucifixes and whatever, sort of descended on him, chased around again, and I tell you, they had the noose around his neck, and they had him up on the lamppost, you know, and he was, and all that, you know. And luckily the police turned up and intervened and cut him down. Otherwise, you know, you'd have been a goner. Absolutely disgraceful, these attacks on Santa. I mean, you know, but in a way they have a point, because he is the most visible hangover from the pagan versions of Christmas, of course. I mean, he is actually an ancient fertility symbol. I mean, he used to traditionally, of course, dress in green. It was actually a part of an advertising campaign for the Coca-Cola company that popularized the image of him dressed in red, but he was like a, you know, sort of a throwback to the ideas of you know, Herne the Hunter. Think of this ancient, powerful pagan fertility symbol, and indeed that's where a lot of the Christian traditions come from. You know, I mean, you know, there's a village in Germany where they still try and enact these every year. You know, this guy dresses as Santa Claus, basically, and he just have a huge beard and everything. He has sort of twigs and things in his beard, and dresses in green, he's covered in leaves and whatever. And every Christmas Eve he comes to the village and he knocks on every door where there's a young maiden with his of his penis, basically, his erect penis. He knocks on the doors. They have to come to the door, and basically in the old days he'd actually impregnate them, you know, showing his fertility, and this is what he's going to, because these days they don't do that, and basically instead they go to the other bit of tradition where basically they all sort of have to give him mince pies and things, you know, because in actual fact that's the origin of mince pie. The word mince is a corruption of the word minge, a popular colloquialism for the female private parts. And the eating of the mince pie is, in fact, a symbolic act of oral sex. Just as the Yule log we have now is, of course, a symbolic representation of sort of Father Christmas's penis. We sort of gorge upon it, sweet and creamy and all that, and we all gorge upon it and everything. You know, he's giving us his fertility. Anyway, this guy goes around this village, gets completely gorged on food and drink, and then eventually what he does, he then stands up on the roof of the highest building, which is actually happens to be the church, and whacks off over the assembled crowd below. Again, symbolic of his jism coming down, you see, and everything. That's why we have this business about snowflakes over at Christmas. It's actually his jism coming down on the crowd again, a symbol of him fertilising and bringing his fertility back to this rural community. I mean, that's what it's all about, you see. I mean, people don't realise this. So. Because Christmas is all about sex. I mean, you know, I know the Christians don't like it, but hey, you know, just look at that tree we bring to our houses. What's it shaped like, eh? And what do we hang from it? That's right, balls. So, I'm afraid whether the Christians like it or not, these are the true origins of Christmas. Oh no, again, for God's sake, Jesus Christ, will they not leave it? But excuse me again, sorry, I'm very sorry about this.
Right, now, I bloody told you,
that was the Sleaze Cast, a Sleaze multimedia production, featuring Doc Sleaze, announcer Susie Sleaze. Produced by Doc Sleaze for the Sleaze.